Chapter 16. Alas! For the rarity of Christian charity under the sun! Oh, it was pitiful! Near a whole city full, home as he had none. Sisterly, brotherly, fatherly, motherly, feelings unchanged. Love, by harsh evidence, thrown from its eminence, even God's providence seeming estranged. Take her up tenderly, lift her with care, fashion it so slenderly, young, and so fair. Ere her limbs frigidly stiffen too rigidly, decently, kindly, smooth and compose them, and her eyes, close them, staring so blindly. Dreadfully staring through muddy impurity, as when with the daring last look of despairing fixed on futurity. Perishing gloomily, spurred by contumely, cold inhumanity, burning insanity, into her rest, cross her hands humbly, as if praying dumbly, over her breast, owning her weakness, her evil behavior, and leaving, with meekness, her sins to her Savior. The vigor of this poem is no less remarkable than its pathos. The versification, although carrying the fanciful to the very verge of the fantastic, is nevertheless admirably adapted to the wild insanity which is the thesis of the poem. Among the minor poems of Lord Byron, is one which has never received from the critics the praise which it undoubtedly deserves. Though the day of my destiny's over, and the star of my fate bath declined, thy soft heart refused to discover the faults which so many could find. Though thy soul with my grief was acquainted, it shrunk not to share it with me, and the love which my spirit bath painted it never bath found but in thee. Then when nature around me is smiling, the last smile which answers to mine, I do not believe it beguiling, because it reminds me of shine. And when winds are at war with the ocean, as the breasts I believed in with me, if their billows excite an emotion, it is that they bear me from thee. Though the rock of my last hope is shivered, and its fragments are sunk in the wave, though I feel that my soul is delivered to pain it shall not be its slave. There is many a pang to pursue me. They may crush, but they shall not contumely. They may torture, but shall not subdue me. 'Tis of thee that I think, not of them. Though human, thou didst not deceive me. Though woman, thou didst not forsake. Though loved, thou forbearest to grieve me. Though slandered, thou never couldst shake. Though trusted, thou didst not disclaim me. Though parted, it was not to fly. Though watchful, 'twas not to defame me, nor mute, that the world might belie. Yet I blame not the world, nor despise it, nor the war of the many with one. If my soul was not fitted to prize it, 'twas folly not sooner to shun. And if dearly that error bath cost me, and more than I once could foresee, I have found that whatever it lost me, it could not deprive me of thee. From the wreck of the past, which bath perished, thus much I at least may recall, it bath taught me that which I most cherished deserved to be dearest of all. In the desert a fountain is springing, in the wide waste there still is a tree, and a bird in the solitude singing, which speaks to my spirit of thee. Although the rhythm here is one of the most difficult, the versification could scarcely be improved. No nobler theme ever engaged the pen of poet. It is the sole elevating idea, that no man can consider himself entitled to complain of fate, while in his adversity he still retains the unwavering love of woman. From Alfred Tennyson, although in perfect sincerity I regard him as the noblest poet that ever lived, I have left myself time to cite only a very brief specimen. I call him, and think him the noblest of poets, not because the impressions he produces are at all times the most profound, not because the poetical excitement which he induces is at all times the most intense, but because it is at all times the most ethereal, in other words, the most elevating and most pure. No poet is so little of the earth, earthy. What I am about to read is from his last long poem, The Princess. Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean, tears from the depth of some divine despair rise in the heart, and gather to the eyes, in looking on the happy autumn fields, and thinking of the days that are no more. Fresh as the first beam glittering on a sail that brings our friends up from the underworld, sad as the last which reddens over one that sinks with all we love below the verge, so sad, so fresh, the days that are no more. Ah, sad and strange as in dark summer dawns the earliest pipe of half-awakened birds to dying ears, when unto dying eyes the casement slowly grows a glimmering square, so sad, so strange, the days that are no more. Dear as remembered kisses after death, unsweet as those by hopeless fancy fainted on lips that are for others, deep as love, deep as first love, and wild with all regret, O death in life, the days that are no more. Thus, although in a very cursory and imperfect manner, I have endeavored to convey to you my conception of the poetic principle. It has been my purpose to suggest that, while this principle itself is strictly and simply the human aspiration for supernal beauty, the manifestation of the principle is always found in an elevating excitement of the soul, quite independent of that passion which is the intoxication of the heart, or of that truth which is the satisfaction of the reason. For in regard to passion, alas, its tendency is to degrade, rather than to elevate the soul. Love, on the contrary, love the true, the divine Eros, the Iranian as distinguished from the Diona tilde and Venus, is unquestionably the purest and truest of all poetical themes. And in regard to truth, if, to be sure, through the attainment of a truth we are led to perceive a harmony where none was apparent before, we experience at once the true poetical effect. But this effect is referable to the harmony alone, and not in the least degree to the truth which merely served to render the harmony manifest. We shall reach, however, more immediately a distinct conception of what the true poetry is, by mere reference to a few of the simple elements which induce in the poet himself the poetical effect. He recognizes the ambrosia which nourishes his soul in the bright orbs that shine in heaven, in the volutes of the flower, in the clustering of low shrubberies, in the waving of the grain fields, in the slanting of tall eastern trees, in the blue distance of mountains, in the grouping of clouds, in the twinkling of half-hidden brooks, in the gleaming of silver rivers, in the repose of sequestered lakes, in the star mirroring depths of lonely wells. He perceives it in the songs of birds, in the harp of bolos, in the sighing of the night wind, in the repining voice of the forest, in the surf that complains to the shore, in the fresh breath of the woods, in the scent of the violet, in the voluptuous perfume of the hyacinth, in the suggestive odor that comes to him at eventide from far distant undiscovered islands, over dim oceans, illimitable and unexplored. He owns it in all noble thoughts, in all unworldly motives, in all holy impulses, in all chivalrous, generous, and self-sacrificing deeds. He feels it in the beauty of woman, in the grace of her step, in the luster of her eye, in the melody of her voice, in her soft laughter, in her sigh, in the harmony of the rustling of her robes. He deeply feels it in her winning endearments, in her burning enthusiasms, in her gentle charities, in her meek and devotional endurances. But above all, far above all, he kneels to it, he worships it in the faith, in the purity, in the strength, in the altogether divine majesty of her love. Let me conclude by the recitation of yet another brief poem, one very different in character from any that I have before quoted. It is by Motherwell, and is called The Song of the Cavalier. With our modern, and altogether rational ideas of the absurdity and impiety of warfare, we are not precisely in that frame of mind best adapted to sympathize with the sentiments, and thus to appreciate the real excellence of the poem. To do this fully, we must identify ourselves in fancy with the soul of the old cavalier. Then mount, brave gallants all, and don your helms amain. These couriers. Fame and honor call, no shrewish tears shall fill your eye, when the sword hilts in our hand, heart whole we'll part, and no whit sigh for the fairest of the land. Let piping swain, and craven white, thus weep and polling cry, our business is like men to fight. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 Old English Poetry asterisk. It should not be doubted that at least one third of the affection with which we regard the elder poets of Great Britain should be attributed to what is, in itself, A thing apart from poetry we mean to the simple love of the antique and that, again, a third of even the proper poetic sentiment inspired by their writings, should be ascribed to a fact which, while it has strict connection with poetry in the abstract, and with the old British poems themselves, should not be looked upon as a merit appertaining to the authors of the poems. Almost every devout admirer of the old bards, if demanded his opinion of their productions, would mention vaguely, yet with perfect sincerity, a sense of dreamy, wild, indefinite, and he would perhaps say, indefinable delight. On being required to point out the source of this so shadowy pleasure, he would be apt to speak of the quaint in phraseology and in general handling. This quaintness is, in fact, a very powerful adjunct to ideality, but in the case in question it arises independently of the author's will, and is altogether apart from his intention. Words and their rhythm are varied. Verses which affect us today with a vivid delight, and which delight, in many instances, may be traced to the one source, quaintness, must have worn in the days of their construction a very commonplace air. This is, of course, no argument against the poems now we mean it, only as against the poets too. There is a growing desire to overrate them. The old English muse was frank, guileless, sincere, and although very learned, still learned without art. No general error evinces a more thorough confusion of ideas than the error of supposing Donne and Cowley metaphysical in the sense wherein Wordsworth and Coleridge are so. With the two former ethics were the end, with the two latter the means. The poet of the creation wished, by highly artificial verse, to inculcate what he supposed to be moral truth, the poet of the ancient mariner, to infuse the poetic sentiment through channels suggested by analysis. The one finished by complete failure what he commenced in the grossest misconception. The other, by a path which could not possibly lead him astray, arrived at a triumph which is not the less glorious, because hidden from the profane eyes of the multitude. But in this view even the metaphysical verse of Cowley is but evidence of the simplicity and single-heartedness of the man. And he was in this, but a type of his school, for we may as well designate in this way the entire class of writers whose poems are bound up in the volume before us, and throughout all of whom there runs a very perceptible general character. They used little art in composition. Their writings sprang immediately from the soul, and partook intensely of that soul's nature. Nor is it difficult to perceive the tendency of this abandon to elevate immeasurably all the energies of mind, but, again, so to mingle the greatest possible fire, force, delicacy, and all good things, with the lowest possible bathos, baldness, and imbecility, as to render it not a matter of doubt that the average results of mind in such a school will be found inferior to those results in one, ceteris paribus, more artificial. We cannot bring ourselves to believe that the selections of the Book of Gems are such as will impart to a poetical reader the clearest possible idea of the beauty of the school, but if the intention had been merely to show the school's character, the attempt might have been considered successful in the highest degree. There are long passages now before us of the most despicable trash, with no merit whatever beyond that of their antiquity. The criticisms of the editor do not particularly please us. His enthusiasm is too general and too vivid not to be false. His opinion, for example, of Sir Henry Wotton's verses on the Queen of Bohemia, that there are few finer things in our language, is untenable and absurd. In such lines we can perceive not one of those higher attributes of piety which belong to her in all circumstances and throughout all time. Here everything is art, nakedly, or but awkwardly concealed. No prepossession for the mere antique, and in this case we can imagine no other prepossession, should induce us to dignify with the sacred name of poetry a series, such as this, of elaborate and threadbare compliments, stitched, apparently, together, without fancy, without plausibility, and without even an attempt at adaptation. in common with all the world, we have been much delighted with the shepherds hunting by withers a poem partaking, in a remarkable degree, of the peculiarities of El Penseroso. Speaking of PC, the author says, by the murmur of a spring, or the least boughs rustling, by a daisy whose leaves spread, shut when Titan goes to bed, or a shady bush or tree, she could more infuse in me than all nature's beauties can in some other wiser man. By her help I also now make this churlish place allow something that may sweeten gladness in the very gall of sadness, the dull loneness, the black shade, that these hanging vaults have made the strange music of the waves. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.